Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Oh, the shape up or care. You've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions I have about religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, you're very welcome along to Team 33 and a call here with you for the next hour or so. Coming up on tonight's show, we will be chatting to Richard Buxton about his new book, Fine Margins, How Man City and Liverpool Has Become a Rivalry of the Modern Era. So Colm Bouygues and Kieran Bradley are on the line with me. It's been a long week, lads. A long week of listening to Red versus Blue. I don't know about you, but I've not taking my face off the CNN screen for about 10 minutes. I think the half an hour chat I recorded with Richard Buxton was the first time I was away from my TV all week.
Kieran, go ahead. Take the floor.
Sure. Yeah, I stayed up till about 4:30 on the night, which was largely pointless after about 2:00 when it became fairly clear that there wasn't going to be an outright victory one way or another. It seemed like everyone on kind of my timeline or whatever was on CNN. This guy John King was pretty, you know, doing some prodigious stuff, but I'm old school. I go BBC. I want a bit of Andrew Neil, your catty K's, and the fact that there's no ad breaks. The fact that Andrew Neil has basically probably had to have a catheter fitted or something. He's going to piss himself, by the way. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, as we record, there's no outright victory at the moment. But it's looking to me, at least, that it's trending in a way that I would be quite happy with.
Colm, how likely is it, do you think, that here and off the ball, we would manage to do what CNN are doing with the rotating presenters constantly at the screen and just like focusing in on every single game? It was like there's a study to be done on that and how they managed to do it, and because it was fascinating. It's like the watching of the counts is as interesting as the entire thing, to be honest.
Oh, it's showbiz, baby. We did it once. We did it a couple of times with the deadline day takeover. We had a rotating cast of shows. You and I, Enda, we did a show at Phil Egan, I think, last Christmas. That was part of some sort of takeover that we did. So it's doable, but nothing. I mean, this is just unbelievable.
Yeah, and I think we would have to do it at 5 a.m. though.
Yeah, well, there's no problem with that. Like, you know, we'll just get some, well, it was a good
money,
good sleep.
Money never sleeps.
But I tell you what, though, much to my chagrin, I realized that I didn't have CNN on my TV package. So I had it for 2016 on another provider I was with. So I flicked onto CNN. It was just unsubscribe, it said. I was, oh my God. So I had to go to Sky News. So I've chosen Sky News over BBC because Sky News, like, you know, they're a poor man CNN, but they're trying. You know, there's a bit of Hollywood to it. But I just can't keep my eyes off that scoreboard. Oh, it's just so sweet when it goes up.
You really do feel sorry for Rupert Murdoch at the minute, don't you? Like, oh, he's really is the poor man whoever owns CNN, really. Does he own CNN? Potentially.
No, sure, that's CNN direct rival to Fox.
He owns Fox. Yeah, sure. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, he'd have no time for CNN. But from what I see, I haven't seen it, so it makes me want to see it more and more again. I'm just going by Twitter. But I find that I'm just constantly refreshing Twitter, like just all the time on my phone. But also, yeah, well, I don't know about you, but this feels like the longest week in a long time because I'm living in this election since Tuesday night Irish time. So you're going hour by hour looking for updates, and each morning you're waking up thinking, "Is it over? Is this it?" And it just goes on.
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned Deadline Day, because at about 3 o'clock in the morning, it did just occur to me that I was basically watching all of Deadline Day. So you're looking for any kind of serotonin boost when there's like, you know, someone's on their way to Old Trafford or something like this.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
it's been a fairly interminable week in that respect. Like, I do like the BBC for that kind of thing, like, because in fairness, CNN, the kind of bells and whistles that you usually see with American news, particularly Fox, and maybe, to a lesser extent CNN, but all the colours and the maps and the tech and stuff, it actually really suits election night. But I like the little, you know, a little bit staid, a little bit like, right, we're getting someone on here who's just a little bit going to tap the brakes a little bit and all that. So, yeah, it's been fun. But anyway, you shouldn't be mentioning those takeovers, Colin, because every time we do, you should have some sort of truth. It's none for 24 hours, 48 hours.
Oh, yeah, there's memes to be made from the faces when you confirm the news that there's a takeover happening. I watched one of your general elections, Kieran, on BBC 2015. and it was very good. They're very good. Because you know what? They're just themselves. They don't try to be different. Whereas Sky News are just hankering for that bit of CNN gold. But I'm hooked for it because it suits America.
Yeah, oh, it does.
You know what I mean? It suits America. Enda, what do you think of all of this?
Well, I was actually, speaking of red versus blue, I was switching over between Fox and CNN. It's something I do on a regular basis anyway, to see like when there's a big story on in like happening in America, say whatever Trump's doing this week, how the two different channels cover it. And it is literally polar opposites. Like it could be, I remember during the riots, like CNN had a nonstop feed off the riots going on in the city, and then Fox were chatting about some lad who had like a local story down in Nevada or something like that there. So they're like, CNN is as bad as Fox, it's just the opposite take on it. So I think it does suit America. I think one thing that struck me is it was really weird, and I said that I followed it all week. I found it weird how interested we all are in this, like why it's literally, they've got a reality TV show former host running in the election, and the election itself has turned into a reality TV show as well, because you forget the massive implications of this because you're just caught up in the race to 270.
Yeah, but there was, like, I remember thinking, I remember people thinking that it was the end of the world in 2016, and that was decided on the night. And I remember the faces of people that I like was living with at the time, and I was working with a couple of hours later, and there were it was an apocalyptic feel to the whole thing. It was the same as the way when Brexit went through, because I remember was that a Thursday night, and there was, you know, the idea was like, oh, that's never going to happen, and then I remember we were out in Dublin, and one of the girls we were with was like, looked up from a phone and was like, I think this is going to go through. And then the next morning, it was just hands in the head, and same with Trump.
Well, I remember his first election as well, clear as day, because I was in college and I was living with a guy who's from America. Well, he's more Irish now than he is American, but he was born raised in America until he was about 10. So he was really interested. So we decided we'll go out in the piss, and then we'll come back at 3-4 in the morning and watch the election. We got home, fell asleep. And then we were living in college digs, so it was like a community, just all apartments full of college students. They decided to do a fire drill at 7 or 7:30 in the morning the next day. So everyone was hungover, getting up, walking outside in their PJs in the pouring rain. And then we just looked at our phones and Trump had been elected. And it was just this is like, what do you call that? What's that word in English now? Pathetic fallacy. It summed up my mood that Trump got elected.
Yeah, the Brexit one was particularly funny for me because I was living here at that point, went back to vote, and then went off to Glastonbury. And Glastonbury on the Thursday night, right? So we're all out, obviously, limited coverage and stuff like that. And, you know, there was a feeling of rough, you know, from my point of view, optimism that it would remain. But I did have a suspicion that they would leave. Anyway, about 4 o'clock in the morning, you're walking back to the tent, and someone, like, the ripple just goes around, like, and everyone's just like, you what? This is unbelievable. And then the rest of the weekend is everyone just being like, guys, no, we're gonna pull through this. And I was like, all right, well, you know, also pull yourself together. But
the Arctic Monkeys didn't stop their set to announce a Brexit. went through. Like, it's it wasn't end. Was that everyone. The Glastonbury that Jeremy Corbyn?
No, that was 2017.
That was crazy. to bring this back to sport, if you were to describe Trump as one team and Biden as one team, who would they be? Ooh. Or let's simplify this. If you were to describe the Republicans in one team and the Democrats in one team, who would it be?
Well, that depends who you ask, because if you're red or blue, you're going to say the team you hate. So, like, I'm obviously going to say the Republicans are akin to Liverpool, but they're not really Liverpool. Who would they be? Who would they be now?
Some sort of uncaring behemoth club. Who could we think of that might be close to our thoughts? Like, come on, United or obviously the Republicans.
Well, there's an obvious one for me. I'm just going to say it, Rangers, because... No, nobody really likes them. And if you ask the actual people involved, they're like, I don't know if I really like them either. I just like hating the other team. So, and also,
you just
also,
made all that up.
or you're looking at probably Real Madrid. Real Madrid are the Republicans, and then Barcelona are the Democrats, because Barcelona like to present themselves as this maison club who are really well developed and really good for the people, when they're really not. Like, they're just the same as Real Madrid. They're just a really rich Spanish club that don't really care at the end of the day. So that's a close enough description, in my opinion, if I do say so myself.
I think the Democrats could be Arsenal. We used to be quite popular with the working class in urban areas, and now have become comfortable middle class. Used to be quite successful, and now not quite where they once were. Although, going through a bit of a resurgence, so potentially.
I'll take that. Colm, any ideas?
I was just thinking there when you said that. If and when Biden wins this, he doesn't have control. The Senate, right?
Yeah, Republicans are in the lead to that.
Well, one of the Georgia seats is up for grabs, basically. It might go to a runoff, but anyway, right. this is all going to be completely redundant by the time anyone's here.
I don't think it will. I think generally speaking, that's what's going to happen, isn't it? And so then he would be like Arsenal, because he'd be doing all the right things, but you're not going to win the league, pal. You're not going to change anything. So. See, the funny thing about this is the world doesn't care if that's the case. They just want to see your man out.
Yeah. To be fair, I think it will calm things down a bit. We are talking to Richard Buxton after the break about Man City and Liverpool, a rivalry that is modern day rivalry, I suppose, in the last couple of years. Like, it's not really, it doesn't have the same, grasp to it as Man United against Liverpool or Man United against Arsenal or... I don't know, Celtic against Rangers. It's just one of these. It's very much on the pitch, as opposed to. I don't think these players dislike each other. I don't think the fans particularly dislike each other. Yeah. I think it's just purely professional, and these are the two best teams. Yeah,
that's okay.
When does it become the United and Arsenal side of rivalry? Because that was just the best two teams.
Yeah, but it won't. I mean, because there was real bitterness there. And I honestly don't think players have that bitterness towards each other anymore. Because, they have, it's like bigger fish to fry. They have other things going on in their lives, basically. But, the best game of football I've seen in a long time was in January 2019 between Man City and Liverpool at the Etihad. The game, the ball was cleared off the line by John Stones and City went on to win the league. And if you think about it, there are actually so few genuinely world-class matches that you watch, really, from the amount of football that you watch. And I remember thinking... this is a sensational match. I was watching in the pub and everybody was into it. Like, even people who weren't watching the match when it kicked off, people started getting into it because of the atmosphere. And if you think about the amount of underwhelming matches that you do get through. So it's a fixture I love, despite, it's the two teams I should hate the most. But the football is, by far the best. They're by far the two best teams in England.
Yeah, and what's interesting about it is that a lot of the games that you would peg as rivalries, like United Arsenal, United Liverpool, whatever, they often end in stalemates, where I think Liverpool and Man City have had some genuinely great games over the last couple of years.
Yeah, the league goes through weird phases, though. There was that period probably around 2011-ish, if memory serves, that you just have these absolute basketball scores of, just end-to-end football. But then, it then settles down and people start to reorganise defences and stuff like this. Like, the City-Liverpool one... look, if you asked either of the sets of fans, like neither of the other team are their biggest rivals. So it's kind of one out of convenience more than anything. It's not helped by quite a collegiate sort of relationship between Guardiola and Klopp. There's obviously a lot of respect there. You know, the interesting part of that Richard Buxton book to me would have been the sort of 70s and the kind of Malcolm Allison eras and, you know, Shankly coming up and handing over to Paisley and all that kind of capable. So, yeah, I'd be interested to hear what he's got to say with regard to the historic rivalry for sure.
Yeah, so before we finish up then, lads, Man City against Liverpool this weekend, the title probably is going to go down to them two again this year. So what are we thinking for this weekend and then the season ahead?
I would say this weekend, I would say Liverpool for both. That was in the tone of Alan Partridge saying, I'll just repeat the question. I just say Liverpool v Man City. And I think was it John Giles said on recently on the show with us that he doesn't think Liverpool will have any particular massive challenge this season. And I tend to agree. I think they are comfortably the best team in the league when they're on it. And they're on it more often than Man City are. So I would say a double win there for Liverpool in that question.
I was thinking, actually, I was listening to Mourinho defending Kane last night. I know this is slightly off topic, but I'll round it back. He was in the Mourinho of old mode and not kind of sulky, grumpy, but actually combative. And I suspect that he thinks that the conditions might suit Spurs to go on some sort of run here. I think he really has kind of got the players that he asked for. He's all things are aligning, and I would genuinely see Spurs as possibly the main contenders to Liverpool this year. City, look, it's been well documented that Pep's in his fifth year, he's never done this at a club before, and someone made the point, which I thought was a cogent one, which was the lack of holiday in between the seasons means that you're going now into a situation where the consistent invective that Guardiola is putting to you, it becomes debilitating so quickly, and they have to be really on their game. I really like Ruben Dias as a defender. He was one I would have liked to have signed for my club, but he I just don't see that defence situation being sorted this season. I think actually it's an old adage, but it's true, like the best defence is winning titles. So
yeah, I think I've been largely unimpressed with City so far this year. And without Aguero, again, like, it's been their problem every single year. Like, when Aguero gets injured, they go on a bad run of form, and he's not going to be fit as often as he would be previously. You mentioned John Giles there, Colm. Happy birthday to John Giles, absolute legend of Irish football. It's his birthday today, and we did a special yesterday about with all his some of the people involved in his career, the likes of Eddie Gray, Kevin Keegan, Graham Souness, Liam Brady. There's tons available online. If you want to catch that, you can listen back to it on the OTB Podcast Network in the app, or you can get it on YouTube as well, youtube.com/offtheball. Kieran, Colm, thanks very much.
Cheers, lads.
Coming up after the break, we will be chatting to Richard Buxton about his new book, Fine Margins, how Liverpool and Man City have forged a new rivalry.
Team 33. This is OTB Sports Radio.
We're talking about Fine Margins and the new book from Richard Buxton. Now, you won't be able to see it on the radio, but people watching on YouTube will be able to see the famous John Stones clearance off the line. One of the key results and one of the key moments and defining moments of the Liverpool-Man City rivalry. Richard, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, good to be on.
So the Liverpool-Man City rivalry isn't one that people would jump to straight away if you ask what are the great rivalries of football, but it definitely is one of the rivalries of the modern era. So firstly, what made you consider writing a book about that?
Well, I had an understanding of the sort of animosity between Liverpool and City, shall we say, going back to my time in journalism, so it's about 10 years or so. So in Gorby, obviously the 2014 title running, when there was a bit of violence outside, you know, City sports coach was attacked outside Anfield, and obviously Steven Gerrard's famous "this does not slip" speech, and City picking Liverpool to the title that season. So I obviously knew sort of there was bones of a rivalry there, but I sort of didn't look into it really until, and it's going to sound strange saying this, until Raheem Sterling took a swing at Joe Gomez in the England team canteen. That was sort of the moment that triggered it really. because obviously the FA had tried to get ahead of the story and try and blow the papers off and put a statement out and said to the papers, hold fire. So basically we set Twitter late tonight and everything's just blowing up. But there must be something in this, because in the past 20-odd years, there's been enough there. How far back does it go? And obviously, the more back you go, you actually realise it goes back to the 1960s and sort of the Bill Shankly era. So that's what sort of was the genesis of it, really.
So a lot of people will associate this with a modern-day rivalry with Man City pipping Liverpool to the title. But that actually happened before in the 70s. And it was the other way about. So this is a rivalry that goes back right to the Bill Shankly era, as you say.
Yeah, and it kind of starts weirdly with, of all people, Dennis Law, because Dennis Law obviously joined City from Huddersfield. Bill Shankly left Huddersfield for Liverpool, and on the back of that, Shankly thought that Law was the sort of player that Liverpool needed, and the board just weren't having it, and Law went to Manchester City, and that was a sort of the moment that sort of kicked it off. But I mean, Bill Shankly and Manchester City had a bit of an interesting relationship, really. I mean, there was actually a time, and we mentioned in the book, that he was actually touted to go to Main Road, or City were going to try and bring him to Main Road, rather. I think when I spoke to people who were covering Liverpool at the time in the 60s, they just said that would never happen. But clearly there was an intent from City to sort of poach Liverpool's modern godfather, really. So it goes back that far, and, you know, it's been various managers who continued it, and various players, and, you know, players defecting, and things happening off the pitch with the supporters. So, I mean, we tagged it as the football's ultimate rivalry, and people do bristle at that a bit. They think it's, you know, an affront to, you know, El Clasico, Liverpool United, Boca Juniors, River Plate, you know, the list goes on. But we're not saying it's the greatest or the most celebrated or anything like that. It's called the ultimate rivalry because of what it incorporates. It has so many layers, and I don't think any other rivalry has this level of depth and diversity to it.
And you're obviously a Scouse, as people can hear from your accent. So I suppose the difference between Scouse culture and Man culture really became apparent when Man United and Liverpool were a great rivalry. Do you think that kind of comes into it as well when you're talking about Man City versus Liverpool?
I think a little bit, yeah. I mean, one thing that I tried to do with the chapters was title them based on various Mancunian and Liverpoolian bands, albums and singles and that sort of thing. And some are a little bit obscure. You have to go back through, you know, there's some really obscure artists from the 70s and 80s. But I think, you know, music and culture, they seem to go hand in hand in the Liverpool, Manchester, rivalry in general, in terms of the cities. And obviously, I wanted to reflect that in the book because, you know, it is a big part of it, you know, more so than anything else. I think football and music are sort of intertwined when it comes to these two cities.
Yeah, and yeah, obviously Simon Hughes wrote a book a while back that was really good about the Las and the connection they had to Liverpool. And obviously with through the 90s, you had the Mancunian bands rising with Stone Roses and Oasis. So it does actually go hand in hand with this, and it's quite an interesting part of this rivalry. In terms of Bill Shankly and Dennis Law and all that there, fast forward to when Bob Paisley takes over the club, that's when we really start to see a rivalry on the pitch as well as off the pitch, because Man City have risen through the couple of divisions below the old Premiership, or the First Division as it was called then. And after a couple of seasons, it's amazing in football how quickly it changed back then, that you could rise from the ashes and become title challengers within a couple of years. But that's what Man City did. And I suppose, did you find the first time you're really seeing these two clubs on the pitch start competing?
I think probably the rivalry started a little bit before that. I think it's sort of the tail end of the Bill Shankly era, the sort of the short-lived Marv Marlison period. Because, I mean, we spoke to Rodney Marsh, we spoke to Ian Callaghan, and, you know, they both were very much of the opinion that Malcolm did a lot of things to effect and had a way of getting under Bill Shankly's skin in ways that he couldn't do with Bob Paisley later on when he came back. So I think it probably starts there. But you're right about how it became a force in English football, and, you know, they won the League Cup in 76, and they looked like they were going to make a good fist to the title challenge against Paisley Liverpool. And it's interesting because Tony Book, who was an everyman at City, became the manager in the same way that Bob Paisley became the manager, sort of a reluctant hero, sort of, you know, quite genteel, I'd say, compared to probably Malcolm Allison and Bill Shankly. So in that respect, I think it's an interesting shift. That is where you first start to see the sort of the rivalry gaining some bones, really, because obviously before that there was odds and sods in games and transfer targets and stuff like that, but not really quite on the level where the two teams are going at it And there's a real, I mean, it would be 4-pointer back then, because obviously 3 points for a win didn't come in for a few more years, but there's a real 4-pointer at Anfield on the, I think it was the Easter weekend. And the turnaround that game, I mean, I've actually watched it back on YouTube, it's incredible. I think City equalised, and then about within about 2 seconds of the pool, have only taken the lead back again. It's like a really quick counter attack, and it's, you know, you're taking football now, but I mean, back then, games were quite meandering, they were quite predictable, you know, patterns of play weren't really sort of, you know, you didn't have that short, sharp break that they had, other than hardware, how he scores the goal. So, yeah, I think that was where it all started, though, really.
Yeah, and Martin Tyler, when Man City pipped the title ahead of United with Aguero goal, he summed it up with, "You'll never see anything quite like this before." But it turns out we actually have seen that quite a few times since. We had the Arsenal 89 title, and then we had the, obviously we'll talk about the Man City pipping Liverpool to the title on the last day of the season more recently. But we also had the 1974-75 season where Man City are beaten to the title by Liverpool by 1 point as well. Talk us through that season.
76-77, I think that was.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sorry, I got my dates.
So it's honestly, I got to a point where when we were going for proof and the fact checkers were going back and going, "Are you sure this is right, this league position at the end of the season?" And because you're pouring over so much information. But yeah, I mean, I think Liverpool probably, it seems to be a habit in the sort of the Pavey era that they would ease up near the finish line once they knew the title was in the bag. And, you know, I think probably they would have probably finished a lot further ahead of City if they'd, you know, I mean, Tuesday, obviously, they were going for a treble at the time, which ended out to be a double in the end. So, a lot of things came into play. But it did show you how close it is and how fine the margins, if you pardon the expression, really are. And obviously, we saw that later on coming into, you know, the 2018-19 season. So, I think, you know, they haven't always been close, but when they have been close, even if they're not fighting for a title, I mean, I think in the early 90s, City and Liverpool were sort of a bit neck and neck for the time in the Peter Reid, pre-Roy Evans era. So there was obviously, they were obviously always quite close, but just never quite at the business end of the table for a lot of these games that they come up against each other.
Yeah, and obviously Man City have a checkered enough history when it comes to the late 80s, early 90s in terms of their league position and even the league that they're playing in. So the rivalry sort of disappears for a while there, and then we see with the City takeover and their rise in English football again, and then Jurgen Klopp takes over at Liverpool. How much of a defining moment do you think that is for Liverpool and City, that Pep Guardiola comes to City and then Jurgen Klopp comes to Liverpool, because the two of them already have a rivalry, so it was almost like bringing that to the English shores?
Yeah, and it's, I think that was probably elevated the rivalry to another level. I mean, you look at the sort of the churches of football that these two managers come from, they're very different. You know, Klopp plays a lot of, you know, heavy pressing, whereas Guardiola prefers the possession-based stats, and I think that sort of added another layer to this. But in terms of elevating the club standings, I think City have got greater consistency, and they did have greater consistency up until last season, and obviously Liverpool have now found their sort of what they consider to be their appropriate level now. So I do think that was a massive turning point. But obviously the fact that the two managers had history in the Bundesliga as well, that was a huge thing, and obviously as well, I mentioned it in the book, and I think Raf Honigstein in his book about Klopp mentioned it as well, that, you know, Liverpool weren't the first team to make a play for Klopp. City did make some sensitive inquiries. Manchester United made a very ham-fisted play for him, and Liverpool just sold him on the history and the identity and what he could bring, and it seems to be a perfect fit. But I think for City as well, I think Guardiola has been incredible, and, you know, hopefully he'll be around the Premier League for years to come.
Yeah, it was almost sold as the heavy metal football against the more refined sort of classical music of Pep Guardiola in terms of their football style. From talking to loads of people, and you speak to loads of people in the book throughout the 70s and the 80s and up until the modern era, how do you think the clubs have changed in terms of how they feel around them in the last couple of years? Like, do you think that, because obviously English football changed so much and so quickly, and so many people were able to win the league back in the 70s and 80s and 90s compared to now, where there's so much money and it really is a race to the finish with who has the tighter purse straps. So do you think that this Man City-Liverpool rivalry is one that we'll see for years to come, or do you think it's is it sustainable, or how do people around the clubs feel about it?
It's a strange one, really, because I think, you know, you speak to City fans and Liverpool fans, and they'll say, well, they're not our rivals in the way that, you know, Man United are to both. I mean, it's sort of, they've got a mutual enemy there, but it does feel like the sort of the intensity, animosity. I mean, you only have to look at the coverage across the two flagship newspapers of the city. You know, the Liverpool Echo, whenever there's an injury to Manchester City, it's billed as good news for Liverpool. And, you know, whenever Liverpool suffer some sort of setback, City do look at it from the Manchester Evening News and say, you know, it could give City an upper hand. So there is a sort of, I think it's grown, especially since, as you say, the Klopp and Guardiola, I think that's really raised the bar. And now you've got this sort of enclave of hierarchy in the Premier League. And we saw with Project Big Picture, you know, the sort of teams that were going to be benefiting, enriched from this planned breakaway. Liverpool and City were right among them. I mean, Liverpool were the driving force, or joint driving force with Man United. But, you know, that shows sort of where their position is in the sort of English football and food game. Whereas if you go back maybe 20 years when City had that fleeting return to the Premier League in 2000-2001, Liverpool were pushing to be in the top four conversation. City were trying to keep their heads above water and ultimately failed, unfortunately. But, you know, since they've come back, they've consolidated and now worked their way up, thanks to the Abu Dhabi takeover, to be one of those top four, top six teams that, you know, we're going to be a driving force. Whatever happens with Big Picture plan, or whatever happens with any European Super League, those two are going to be front and centre of it now, I think.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one that you bring up, the animosity between the two clubs. Because I suppose when you think about traditional rivalries, you think the Roy Keane versus Vieira in the tunnel incident when it was Man United, Arsenal fighting for the title, or even just the animosity between Liverpool and Manchester United fans. That doesn't seem to be there when you talk about Man City, Liverpool. It seems to be very much a rivalry on the pitch and not between the two clubs, just between two fantastic football teams. Do you think is that due to modern era football in terms of it's just a little bit cleaner now and it's more refined? Or do you think is that because it's still sort of a new thing between these two clubs?
Probably a bit of both. I mean, to be honest, I do kind of sort of keep an eye on sort of what the fans are saying on various message boards. And obviously, you know, I mean, Blue Moon's a driving force of the City fans, and Liverpool does get, it's got some dedicated thread there. And I don't think there's, I wouldn't say it's friendly, put it that way. And I think when you look on the club message boards, the same thing about City said, there's a real political hatred creeping in. And I think that's probably social media's around that aspect of things. And you know, we've seen it, you mentioned the election before. You know, you're seeing that people are getting drawn into the sort of the tribe and defending them vehemently. So I think it's probably growing, but maybe not as much as you say. You know, United Arsenal hasn't been at the level it's been, you know, 15 years ago. United Liverpool probably even less. So I mean, I think you count on one hand how many times Liverpool United have really been in direct conflict in the Premier League and in other competitions. It's very rare. So I think and does wear away a lot of these sorts of hostilities, but you know, a lot of people will always be at the forefront of their minds. But I do think Liverpool City is growing, and you saw, you know, I mean, I write about the bus attack, and I write about it from a sort of, you know, a personal insight, because I was outside on Anfield Road waiting to see the sort of film, shoot photographs, stuff, that sort of thing, you know, because, you know, a print journalist isn't just a print journalist anymore. Mm. But there were things that, you know, when people talk about the bus attack, you know, idiots. You know, it was more than that. It was, you know, it became a cultural phenomenon, that event, before, you know, what happened to the City coach happened. So, you know, that sort of thing of, you know, ramping up the rivalry has been there. On both sides, probably predominantly the Liverpool side, because they see City as the sort of young star to it. They were, you know, trying to muscle in on their sort of patch in terms of being a successful and winning machine. But, you know, City have got the history going back to the 60s. You know, they had one. A European trophy before Liverpool, so you know, saying City to some newcomers with a bit of money, and you know, these old council club jokes that we get from Liverpool fans, which is based on the ownership of the Etihad Stadium, the tenancy of the Etihad Stadium. You know, that sort of thing is you know, it's thrown up, but it doesn't really paint the accurate picture of where Liverpool and City are as clubs. I think, you know, City aren't. They haven't done a Roman Abramovich. They've had a bit of help, yes, from the Abu Dhabi ownership, but you know, they still try to push their academy prospects forward. They still try to do everything the right way. know, and similar to Liverpool, you know, we haven't just thrown money at the problem and it's gone away. It's sort of been an organic thing. So I do think the rivalry does, it does sort of change with the current landscape, especially in the sort of behind closed door settings. You know, what you would see at the Etihad on Sunday, you're not going to see because it's going to be played out on social media. But I do think social media is where this is sort of come to life, really.
Yeah, so you cover both clubs, which is quite an interesting job. So what was it like being outside that bus attack, for example, in terms of how do you approach that in terms of coverage?
It's tough, really. I mean, I didn't really pass comments on it at the time because I don't think it was really the sort of thing to pass comments on. And also, you know, I've got a foot in three camps because I cover mainly City, Liverpool and Everton. So, you know, you kind of traverse a bit of a fine line trying to not upset one side to please the other. So, I mean, at the time, it was, you know, details were very sketchy. It was sort of, but what, similar to, unfortunately, the Sean Cox sack, you know, I was there that night as well. I was actually standing outside the press entrance and all the police and stewards running down the press entrance to run out to Wanbrook Road. So, you know, but a lot of details like that night were very sketchy. So, you know, you were relying on what the police put out, what the clubs put out. And it was only when you saw the footage from inside the bus, which is available on YouTube, I think one of Pep Guardiola's technical assistants put it up. It's I know the multi-million footballers, I know they live a very charmed life, but if you put anyone in that situation, that is terrifying. And that must have been a tough experience for them. And I think it was reflected in the performance of the team that night. But in terms of, you know, it gets brought up now, and, you know, Liverpool fans use it to sort of go City fans, and City fans use it to sort of berate Liverpool fans. It's sort of become a point scoring exercise. But, you know, that night, I don't think really anyone who sort of was involved in the sort of the organisation of it, shall we say, whether it's from the authorities or people who put it out on social media without any accountability. I think no one was out looking that night, so I think it's going to be a contentious one for years to come, really.
And in terms of covering these two clubs, you're obviously in quite a privileged position that you can go to the press conferences and you can get a sort of a feeler on the players and the managers and how they're feeling outside of what the normal audience would do. So in the last couple of years when the pressure has been on, what have you noticed in terms of the two managers, in terms of Klopp and Pep Guardiola, in their mood changes and their personalities during when the pressure was really on? Like, for example, when Man City were taking on Liverpool in the Champions League, and when it was those fine 2 years that were really, really tight, what was the differences between covering each club?
I think you get more of an insight into the managers' mentalities and emotions away from the games, really. I think they are quite guarded because, you know, anything they say will become a focal point. And obviously, Pep Guardiola broke rank from that in the aftermath of the Anfield Champions League game 2 years ago because he was shell-shocked, essentially, and rightly so. You know, I mean, don't expect someone there, you know, a hail of bottles, cigarette lighters, flare canisters, you name it, coins. That must have been a bruising experience. So Pep obviously was a pain to talk about that after the game. But it's interesting when Liverpool brought up to Pep and when Manchester City brought up to Klopp, because I've been at a lot of the games and press conferences when it has happened outside of the normal Liverpool City setting. And it's been interesting because I think, you know, Pep is quite defensive of his team, quite, you know, regimented in what he says and does in terms of defending, you know, the protest. So do we know about his part of notification of City, and we know how it worked in the new camp, how it worked at Bayern Munich. So he's always believed in the protest, where Klopp's a little bit more emotionally invested. I'd say he's happy to say shit when he feels he needs to say it. You know, he's made very salient points about things like the winter breaks and about, you know, TV coverage and that sort of thing, and even, you know, became a mouthpiece for the coronavirus situation in March, when, you know, every question seems to be coming to him, and he thinks he's passed the book initially, and then, you know, the more people pushed it, he'd start pointing the finger at people. I think that was, you know, that gave you an interesting sort of what sort of manager Klopp is. He's very, very combative, I'd say, whereas I think Klopp, Guardiola's a little bit more diplomatic, but I mean, it's a bad thing. I think Klopp being combative has actually helped over the door. You look at the way, you know, they haven't had the rubber green on VAR recently, and then, you know, he makes a point about it, and then the one time they do have a VAR call, they could go against them, not against West Ham, penalty. directly, I've got to ask, you know, so it does have a benefit, and similar to Guardiola's, I think that, you know, they have very different outlook on football, but they clearly get the same results, and that's what, you know, he potentially wants.
Yeah, I definitely do think that Klopp is more emotional when it comes to it, and I do agree, and I'm glad you brought it up, that when you push Klopp, there is a bit of a bite there. If you start to push the dog in the wrong spots, and he eventually will snap at you, and that definitely does come across with Klopp. But that's essentially what makes him a winner as well, because people think he's just this Mr. Nice Guy, but there, deep down, there is a real drive with Klopp.
Yeah, and I think the perception of Klopp is quite strange. I mean, I know that over here in the UK, Spitting Images had a bit of a reboot, and, you know, Klopp is apparently quite extensively, you know, a short guy who's just, you know, a bit daft, just laughs at everything, you know, whatever's thrown at him, and his team just laughs at it. He doesn't really, you know, fight for the team. He's sort of, you know, just whatever. But that's not the reality, and, you know, you see the way he is. He's not just the guy who just goes, you know, starts, you know, fist pumping in front of the cop after a win. He does have a battle hard mentality. And I think that's probably what sets us apart from Pep a little bit, because Pep is, you know, the ultimate purist. You know, learned at the knee of Johan Cruyff and took those values and that philosophy right down to the letter, where the Klopp is a bit more, I'd say probably a bit more unique in his approach, as he will put the team that goes out and runs through brick walls from. It won't always work, but, you know, that's the method he goes with, and it's constant. And, you know, you see the demands on the players, and, you know, the stats must be absolutely incredible, the running stats for the miles he put in. And that shows you sort of what Klopp wants. He wants battles. He doesn't want to be sort of, I mean, a Pep Guardiola light, which was, you know, what his predecessor Brendan Rodgers essentially was when he was at Liverpool, and that was probably what cost him the Premier League title in 2014. So I think battling and, you know, digging in is what Klopp does. And that's why he was renowned as a bit of an English coach when he was in Germany, and the heavy metal football tag did sort of bring traction then.
Yeah. Well, I know who I'd rather get chat out by, and it's definitely not Klopp. But I suppose over the next couple of years, Liverpool, Man City are favourites again this year to be battling out for the title. I've brought up the United-Arsenal rivalry in a couple of occasions, because you see now with Sky Sports, even to this day, they still have this in their head that Manchester United against Arsenal is one of the great rivalries. And you see the same with Manchester United against Liverpool with the likes of Red Monday a couple of years ago, and things like that, everlasting rivalries that even when they're now contending for the title, it still is in the mind that these once were two big giant clubs of the past, and they still are. At what stage does Liverpool, Man City get into that bracket?
I think it should be already being there now, based on obviously the evidence here. But in terms of the Red Monday thing, it was quite prominent, and, you know, I think Sky got the fingers bent a little bit by the goals draw that night. But I think probably in the next, a lot of it's going to depend on probably, you know, the future of Pep Guardiola. If Pep sticks around the City, which he's hoping to do, but obviously he feels he's got to earn it. He's got to, you know, merit a new contract extension, even though City hierarchy is saying we'll give you it, no problem. I think if Pep sticks around and sort of creates this sort of a tapestry with Klopp to the City Liverpool rivalry as a whole, I think it should start becoming in the sort of the United Liverpool to a lesser extent. I think if you look at the United Arsenal thing, you know, that was honed on Agnes. You know, you had Wenger, Ferguson, Keane, Vieira, you know, I mean, you even go back up to Ferris, Michael Ian Rice, you know. Liverpool and City has, you know, the managerial protagonist, but maybe not quite the level of you know, on field protagonists. I mean, they'd probably be closer to a bit of needles, probably the fall from the Manny Edison situation, but, you know, that wasn't intentional. It wasn't like, you know, with Keane obviously going out to Melvin Gahan and the Manchester Derby. It wasn't that sort of thing. So, you know, until we end up with, you know, someone really saying close to the wind, which hopefully they don't, for the sake of fair play and you know, objectivity, then I don't think it'll ever be sort of on that level, because I think, as you say, the time's changed. You know, football has become more sanitised than it was probably in the you know, the United Arts era, especially when you look at how Ferguson derided Wenger when he came in. He said, you know, he's just come from Japan, what does he know, basically? And that's the sort of thing. You're not going to have that with with, you know, the PR savvy Premier League now being what it is. So it's probably going to take a few years, and probably needs, you know, both needs to be really up there for it to be considered in the mainstream, be considered, you know, one of the bigger rivalries. But, you know, there is going to be enough fanfare there now. I mean, Sunday Sky Sports are probably going to be in overdrive in terms of building up to the game. So I think we're probably up there in that respect. But in terms of, you know, becoming a sort of, you know, sweeping rivalry where, you know, everyone knows about it, it's in every, you know, facet of public life, I think it's probably a few years ago.
So in terms of this weekend then and this season, obviously Liverpool lost Virgil van Dijk, but they've started quite well, and Man City have sort of been a little lackluster again this year without Aguero, and Gabriel Jesus not really on the score sheet as often as Man City might like. Have you been going to the games, first of all, or are you working remotely at the minute?
A bit of both. I mean, I've had to cover City from a distance because obviously they've got limited space, and obviously they have regulars who go every week, and they say best in the sport. You know, the trade-off of that is that, you know, I've been going to Everton Liverpool weekly since lockdown kicked in, more or less, been to every game. So, you know, it's good to be at the grounds and see you know, a bit of insight to what's going on. But I think when you watch from a distance, you know, you're basically like the rest of the world. You're watching on the screen and you can't really, you know, see things. You can't see what the manager's doing. You can't see what sort of patterns of play are opening up. Whereas when you're in the ground, you can sort of see it because you're especially in, you know, Anfield, Goodison, those sorts of grounds, you're at a higher vantage point. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I've been intrigued by Liverpool because, you know, there is a danger of them dropping off, you know, monumental title win after 30 years. And you know, we saw it in the sort of the post cycle come down. You know, they had a few iffy results, obviously losing to Arsenal, being trounced by City, drawn with Burnley. You know, those sorts of games, you know, if that was pre-lockdown, if that was pre-winning the title, they probably would have at least come out of it with them, you know, without losing, or, you know, in the Burnley case, winning. I think Liverpool have done well to bounce back. City, I think, when you look at the performances, they're not perfect enough in terms of the chances they create. They're not finishing them off, and especially it was a case in point, it was so wasteful again. But I think a lot of that is down to losing Aguero. I mean, Aguero is one of the best players in Premier League history. So if you haven't got him even at 32-33, it's still going to come home to roost. And obviously Gabriel Jesus, as you say, you know, he had his best runs of run and form when Aguero's been alongside him. So, you know, he's feeling it as well. So I think it's City are probably slightly the underdog. But then again, you know, they've still got that 5-0 win bank from July. So that should hopefully, you know, make it a bit more of an even contest. But on current form, you probably do look for the favourites.
Just before we finish up, Richard, so you've been covering games at Anfield. So what is the difference? I suppose if you're thinking about certain stadiums in the world that it would be different covering behind closed doors, Anfield is certainly one that stands out. So it must be a bit of a surreal experience.
Yeah, massively so. And I think, I mean, I went to the Michelin game last week, and it really came home how monumental the whole behind closed doors thing is, because the last time the Champions League game was at Anfield, you know, there were 50,000 people there, rightly or wrongly, because of the Atletico Madrid situation. Banners, you know, it was real fair and nice. And then to just see this, these sort of, it's just been spanned for 90 minutes, it does bring it home to you. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't a great game, it was quite languid in parts. And that's the sort of game where the crowd would shield the Liverpool team and, you know, get on the opponent's back. And that sort of our championship, I think that's taken the thing off the games. And probably why we've seen the obscure results, obviously, you know, Villa winning 7-2, you know. The list goes on. It's been a surreal sort of time, and I think these weird results, until fans come back, until we get back into that sort of ebb and flow of what used to be normality, I think they're going to continue for the rest of the season. So we could see probably some of the Liverpool City being up there, but you'd like to think that both teams will have enough to be in the conversation, at least.
So Liverpool Man City this weekend. If you want to read more about the rivalry and how it's becoming more of a thing and how it was as a big thing back in the Bill Shankly and Bob Paisley eras as well, then get on to Fine Margins by Richard Buxton. It's a really good book filled with tons of interviews, tons of sources from back then as well, and loads of information about the title run in 2018-19 and beyond that as well. Richard, thanks very much for joining me today.
Cheers, Ed.
Team 33. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Now, welcome back to Team 33 and a call here. So that is about all we have time for on this evening's show. If you want to listen back to any of that, you can catch it as usual in the usual places on the OTB Podcast Network, on the OTB Sports app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on Spotify and iTunes as well, if you prefer to listen there. And you can watch back that chat with Richard Buxton as well on the Off the Ball YouTube channel, youtube.com/offtheball. We will be back again in the same time, same place. But until then, take away, Johan.